This episode is brought to you by Quarter. Quarter is the new way of doing company research. Quarter's first mission is to enable access to conference calls, investor presentations, transcripts, and earnings reports as frictionless as possible, straight to your pocket. I started using Quarter and I've never looked back. You can think of Quarter as the Spotify for all investor conference calls that you can think of. You can type in the ticker of whatever company you want, say it's Etsy, and you can get a list of all of their recent earnings calls, and inside the earnings calls, you can listen and click the PDF and it'll show you investor presentations or prepared remarks that you can read alongside listening. The best part is you can choose the speeds. You can have 1x, 1.2, 1.5, which is my favorite, and you can star companies, make them your favorites, and you'll get notifications for new conference calls and they'll be right at the top of your app. So there's five key points to remember about Quarter. First, it's 100% free. They include companies from 12 markets and plan to add more over the coming year. They prioritize requested companies, which you can do in the app, and they have a lot more in store. So check them out on wherever app store you have. It's Quartr. That's Quartr. This episode is brought to you by BullpenCareers.com. Bullpen Careers is the best place to find young talent and the easiest place to find a job. Founded by former podcast guest Edwin Dorsey, the job board connects tomorrow's analysts with today's best companies. Some of the featured companies include Citadel, Citron Research, Point 72, and Bridgewater, to name a few. If you or someone you know wants a job in finance, head on over to bullpencareers.com today. That's bullpencareers.com. All right, guys, this is Brandon from the Value Hive podcast, and I have a popular or most requested guest recently is Harris Perlman, and you guys on Twitter will probably know him as Otter Market, O-T-T-E-R, market, like the animal. And I wanted to bring Harris on as a testament to kind of discovering the anonymous side of Twitter, because I think a lot of the best accounts are anonymous or kind of pseudo-anonymous, and Harris definitely fits that profile. We've got a lot of user questions from Twitter, and we've got a lot of questions that I kind of want to dig in. So to begin with, Harris, who are you and how did you get started investing?
Yeah, sure. So first off, really happy to be here. This is my first podcast, so, should be fun. Well, who I am. So, my name is Harris. I'm 30 years old. I got started in investing. I learned about investing originally from my dad, and my dad wasn't really focused on fundamental analysis. He's a doctor, near retirement at this point. But he was always doing technical analysis. So when I was a kid, he actually was trying to teach me how to do charting. And I had no interest in that. I was like reading my Spider-Man comic books, and he was like, hey, you got to watch this tape. This guy's got these patterns and it's really cool stuff. You can make a lot of money doing this. And I had nothing, like no interest in that.
Yeah.
But he kind of got me interested in the idea of like the stock market. And when I got a little older, I started thinking about what I wanted to do for college. I was starting to feel like, the business stuff was really kind of pulling at me. I did some like small side businesses when I was a kid. So I was always kind of had like a little bit of a interest in making money and like learning about businesses. And I really like games also. So I was going down the engineering track when I was going to college, but I started thinking about the finance stuff and the stock market more. And then I really dove into it when I got to college and, ended up being the co-founder and co-president of the investing club at my school. Ended up investing my personal account at that time as well. And that's when I got introduced also to the smaller cap stuff kind of right off the bat. I could tell that was sort of where, I kind of liked the action of doing a lot of research and understanding stuff with these little companies. It just really appealed to me kind of off the beaten track. So that's how I got started in it.
So that's interesting that your dad was doing technical analysis, because I love charts. I mean, if anybody follows me, I can't help but post some fun charts. It's just kind of a side of me that I'll never let go. Was it just basic bare bones technical analysis, like, rectangles, triangles?
No. He had all sorts of stuff.
Like Fibonacci's and stuff like that.
There was the pitchforks. I don't even know what this stuff is. There were a bunch of different guys. He had VHS tapes. It was a lot of stuff. I mean, I kind of had the feeling like if it really worked that well, he'd probably be retired already. So I kind of had some kind of weird vibes just from the get-go. Like, maybe this isn't actually such a sure thing, but I'm glad that at least that introduced me to the market, because that's how I started learning about it.
The only time I've seen pitchforks is on TradingView when I accidentally click on it instead of trying to draw just like a regular line. It gives me the pitchfork.
You know, I don't do any technical analysis. I haven't done any technical analysis really in my entire investing career to date.
Well, fishing where you are in small microcaps, it really doesn't make a difference because the price movements are so how do I say this? The supply and demand movements are so non-fundamental at times that even the stocks like that are super illiquid, it doesn't really matter if they break resistance because that could just be one person trying to buy a boat for their family or something.
You know, when I was learning about it from my dad, I kind of got the sense that some of it was about trying to figure out what the smart money was doing and finding patterns and what, you know, the people who really understood what the companies were doing, you know, these guys were buying or selling and they had sort of, there were sort of tracks that they left in the market of what they were doing. And I think if you, perhaps if you look today at some of the companies that I've bought or sold, or some of my other friends, investor friends have bought or sold, you know, I'm curious if you'd actually be able to see patterns that would be picked up in those sorts of analysis, but right. I don't make any effort to do that.
Yeah. So when you're in college, you're co-president of your investment team, you started investing your own personal money. What was your strategy like at that point?
Yeah, well, I was getting really good at losing money. And so I started off, you know, I guess I learned about kind of value investing pretty early on. So I understood, okay, I'm going to try to buy stuff that's cheap. So in 2010, that meant I was learning about dry bulk shipping because I did some screens of stocks with, you know, low PE multiples. And, you know, whatever, I was 18 years old, 19 years old. And I saw these companies that were making a bunch of money, you know, run by some sleazy Greek guy. And I actually thought my analysis wasn't half bad. I started doing stuff with doing NAV analysis on the secondhand values of the ships and figuring out the contract lengths. But at the end of the day, a lot of these guys just stole a lot of the value that were in these things. And I really didn't know what I was doing. I started finding some other cheap stuff. Some of them ended up being Chinese frauds that were listed on the NASDAQ.
Yep.
Fortunately, I didn't lose money on those because I had at least a grain of common sense to figure out that this stuff didn't really make sense. You know, they have a website that looks like it was made by, you know, a teenager, and the company is supposed to be, you know, worth hundreds of millions of dollars. But I started finding a little bit of stuff that was working, and I was finding some stuff in the microcap space. Some of it was over the counter market stuff. I couldn't tell you how I was coming across it. I mean, I was reading a lot of articles. You know, Google Finance used to have a feature back when there was like a Google Finance where they would tell you a list of companies that were similar to anything that you were punching in. So I would just look at like the smallest companies. Every time I looked at a stock, I would just look at like the smallest companies that were similar to that one in the same field. And I was just kind of, you know, stumbling across things every now and then. I actually ended up subscribing to, you know, Geo Investing. Maj had a microcap subscription service at the time. You know, hey, sorry, Maj, for listening to this. I got a free student subscription for like a month, but they never canceled it. So I just had like a free subscription to Geo Investing for like years after that. and I thought that was, I really liked Maj, but I didn't have any money to pay for it. So and I was learning along with some of my friends who were also in the investing club. You know, we didn't have an infrastructure for the investing club. So we were teaching ourselves. I was teaching myself and my co-founder, and we were all doing this. We, you know, there was a Bloomberg terminal on campus. We taught ourselves how to use the basics of a Bloomberg terminal, how right. to look at SEC filings, a lot of self-teaching in those days.
That's awesome. And it's funny how you mentioned your initial start into investing, because it's so similar to mine. I was just quantitatively screening for these cheap stocks and finding pump and dumps and finding Chinese frauds that had what I thought was a net like $50 million in cash on the balance sheet, no debt, trading at times earnings.
They were no-brainers, right?
Yeah, they were no-brainers.
Horrible that they sucked you in like that.
So one question I do have, and it was asked by a few other people on Twitter, how were you able to become a full-time investor so quickly? I guess, you know, quickly being relative because you're fairly young. So how are you able to do that?
Yeah. So I guess to tell you that, I have to kind of fast forward a little bit. So you know, as this was all playing out, you know, I was in college, I was starting to get a feel for, you know, actually how to invest, how to be an intelligent investor. And so I ended up, you know, getting a job in the industry after graduation. I was at BlackRock for a year, and then I worked at a hedge fund, which is where I spent, I guess you'd call it like the bulk of my, you know, career, which is, I was there for a little over 4 years. And it took me some time to kind of figure out what I wanted out of this whole, you know, trajectory in the investment world. So I'd say that in the beginning, I really didn't have a real goal. I didn't really understand what path I was on. Mm-hmm. And it was probably around 2015 or so, maybe a little earlier, maybe like 2014, I actually started reading about the FIRE movement, which you've probably heard of, the Financial Independence Retire Early movement, yes. Which is all about, you know, just getting sort of a nest egg together and being very frugal, and you can kind of live off of that. So it really appealed to me because I couldn't really see myself at that time ever starting a fund, or I didn't really want to work for other people. So I liked the idea of that a lot. So I was living in New York. I had, I shared my apartment with a couple of friends. And even though I, at that time, started making some decent money, I mean, you know, you're going to make okay money if you work at a hedge fund. But I was really just living like a college student. And my goal was to reach a level of investable portfolio where I thought I could support myself and hopefully grow it. So I had a target. I've been public about this. I think I've mentioned it maybe on Twitter thread or at Microcap Club as well. My personal target was at $800,000 of investable assets. And I ended up hitting that around the end of 2017.
Wow.
And that's when I gave my notice at my job, and I was, you know, off to the races, and I've had a good run since then. So, things have gone well.
That's fantastic. I think it's important for people to hear that because it is possible. Granted, working at a hedge fund is definitely a great start, a kind of a great place to start your FIRE journey. But again, that's almost offset by the fact that you lived in New York. I mean, I assume it was New York City, right? So making $150,000 is like the equivalent of making $35,000 somewhere else.
Yeah, you know, I ended up making a little bit more than that towards the end, but still, I was really. It probably wasn't a very glamorous time to be my ex-girlfriends back then. So, you know, I wasn't really taking people out to fancy dinners. We weren't like going on these, I've never been out to the Hamptons. We weren't really doing this with me and my friend. I wasn't doing this with me and my friends. I wasn't doing a lot of this like fancy spending personally. At the same time, it was a little challenging because people who work in the industry probably see this as well. There's a lot of regulatory and compliance issues. So if you're looking to invest your own capital when you're working full time for a financial firm, you know, that's really hard to do. So right. I was especially motivated to start on my own as quickly as possible because I really had a lot of difficulty doing any trading on my own when I was employed.
Yeah.
So I really needed to get out of there to feel like, okay, now I can accelerate my compounding.
And were you studying small microcaps at this hedge fund, or was it a larger shop where you were looking at multi-billion dollar companies?
Yeah, we were mostly looking at bigger stuff. I can't really talk about the details of what we were doing, but it was a fairly sizable place, and just the scale requirements made it very difficult to do the kind of things that I'm doing now.
Yeah. Well, let's pivot now to your noted mistakes that you recently tweeted about. There's, I think, five companies. And I want to use these mistakes as a way to almost invert how you currently think about your investing framework, because there's lessons that you can obviously take from these. So the five tickers are AXL, MUEL, BILB, CTO, and GCM. And my question around these five are, what are the mistakes that strike you as particularly worthy of remembering? So in other words, the mistakes that kind of stung and left the deepest scars. And then how has your investment process evolved from these mistakes?
Yeah, sure. That's just the list from the last few years, man. I'd say that the mistakes that really hurt the most, well, I guess I should say, The stuff that really hurts are things that are really mistakes. You know, you can lose money even on a good bet that just doesn't go your way, right? I think a lot of these were things that really were mistakes. So I can go down the list. Well, the first one, Arrow, AXL is Arrow, Arrow Energy or Exploration. It's listed in Canada. It's an oil company, tiny oil company. I really didn't know a lot about oil when I invested in it. It was a spinoff, which really attracted me. So I was looking at it as sort of like an orphan security. And I guess you'd say it was an expensive lesson in oil economics, because going into it, I really didn't know a lot about oil economics. And coming out of it, I knew a lot about, you know, the problems of understanding or trying to understand oil companies and the ways that you can, you know, be misled or otherwise just fail to appreciate the downsides and the risks. So really the problem there was that the company had wells that were running out of oil very quickly. And I was focused on certain multiples, kind of naively, I was focused on certain multiples around the enterprise value relative to the company's production, and not really around enough of the unit economics. So It was an error. I got excited about it because it was a spinoff and the numbers originally sounded like they could be interesting. But you know, I had to exit and I, you know, made a mistake on that. Trying to think, that's the next one, I think was MUEL. That's
correct.
Paul Mueller. You know, to be honest, I'm still tempted. Every time I look at Paul Mueller, I still think about maybe I want to buy some of it again. So it's an industrial company. It's you know, based in Missouri or somewhere around there in the U.S. It's you know,
yep. Springfield.
It's kind of a, yeah. Springfield, okay. So the thing about that company is I think they're actually pretty well run. They seem to, you know, make a decent profit most years. And it's sort of a family controlled, sleepy kind of looking company. The problem is with that one was that, you know, when I started out investing, I was always really, really looking for earnings yields, you know, PE multiples. That was always the thing that really drew me in, number one. And it, to an extent, it's still the thing that I really look at, kind of first and foremost. But as I've gotten a little bit better, I've spent more and more time on capital allocation and return on equity. I'm actually kind of ashamed to admit how long it's taken me to really appreciate, to kind of like internalize the importance of return on equity and reinvesting. So in that case, you know, I think the company has been troubled by some poor capital allocation decisions. And I kind of should have known this because they were spending money on an expansion project in Europe, which, you know, I think I had enough information having spoken with the CFO to realize that it probably wasn't a good use of capital. I think some family owned companies or family controlled companies are kind of plagued by not focusing on return on equity. Instead, they're just thinking about, you know, maintaining the business and keeping it alive for the next generation. Yeah. So that's a situation where I think, you know, I should have realized earlier that this is a problem. And, you know, even if they're making money, it's possibly just going to get poured into new expansion projects.
Yeah. And this is one that, and again, if this is right, I'm using TradingView's data, but market cap about 57 million, 56 million, and they did 200 million in revenue last year.
Oh yeah. And they're profitable. I mean, I forget the numbers off the top of my head. I think they made over 10 million of profit in the last 12 months. If you might have to adjust for some sort of impairment charge, but yeah, if you look at it from an earnings multiple basis, it's one of the cheapest stocks out there.
Yep.
And there are a lot of companies. I feel like if I was in control, if I was running the show, I think it would be awesome to own at that valuation. But if you don't have the control, you have to really, you know, you have to really worry about that.
Right. And so let's go to BILB, Bilb. What do they do? What was the mistake?
Yes. Oh, so you know, I have had very little luck investing in the UK, and this is a UK company, Bilb. Yeah, this was really, I made probably a few mistakes on this one. You know, I started an initial position in the company. It was a small position, fortunately, and it was right before it turned out that there was a whole a whole mess around some bad contracts. They're a company that they do building maintenance, and they had entered into some bad contracts to kind of overexpand. They agreed to do work at, you know, negative margins. The CEO basically left the business, sold all of his stock before this was revealed. The whole thing just stunk ex post. But at the time, having calls with, you know, the management, it seemed like everything was fine. There were a lot of flags, and I was drawn in because, again, it was at a low multiple. It's actually a capital light business. You don't really need to spend a lot of money on equipment to maintain buildings. You just have to have, you know, people. And it was growing. It was growing by acquisitions. It seemed to be, you know, attractive multiples on those acquisitions. And, you know, it was sort of my mistake additionally to stick with it, even after I was blindsided by the bad news about these bad contracts. And if I had done more research around the industry, I think I would have realized earlier that the industry has had these problems repeatedly. It's been, you know, pervasive. There are other outsourcing businesses in the UK that overexpanded or agreed to do work at, you know, terrible pricing, and subsequently blew up. So if I had understood the industry landscape, then I probably would have been a lot more wary to begin with. And like I said, I mean, I haven't had a lot of success in the UK. I feel like as an American, you know, the UK might seem attractive because, you know, they speak English or some version of it. And it seems like it should be possible to understand what's going on. But, you know, it makes things that much more challenging because you're not on the ground. You don't really understand the market so well. I should have been more worried about that one from what I could see.
It's funny you mentioned UK stocks, because for a while, I think it was a few months ago, I loved scanning the UK universe, because I think there are so many interesting businesses trading at pretty attractive prices over there. But again, I mean, there's that cultural difference. And I think investors, myself included, get lured in by it's ex-US and oh, everything's in English. So I don't need to Google translate the financial documents.
Yeah, you know, and it feels like there's a whole system in place in the UK that I'm not really plugged into. The sell side research reports are sort of, you know, disseminated around there. Just getting access to the AIM market, which is the small cap, you know, UK exchange. It's really challenging to get liquidity there. If you're not a local, then you can't really access the real-time liquidity. They have a really terrible auction system. You know, overall, I think unless you're really plugged into the market, it's probably also to do with the fact that it is it's a very developed market. So it's not like one of these markets where, yeah, you can understand what's going on and there aren't a lot of people looking at it. It's a market where you might be able to understand, you know, the filings, but, you know, there's a lot of other intelligent people who are reading the same stuff. So I think that's the part that kind of turns me off.
And then the last two mistakes, CTO and GCM, if you want to quickly review what those mistakes were.
So, CTO, first of all, I still own some. You know, really, I think it's a decent little manufacturing company. But unfortunately, I was too focused on estimates around their earnings. And realistically, I thought that they were going to increase their return on equity with an acquisition or two that they had done that I thought was moving them into higher quality business lines. It just didn't play out. I mean, it's not a terrible mistake. I didn't lose any money on that one. And actually on GCM, it actually was one of my most successful investments from a profit perspective, but I'd still classify it as a mistake because in that case, GCM, Grand Columbia, they own a gold mine, or now they actually have a few different gold mining assets, but their core asset is a gold mine in Colombia, very profitable gold mine. I spent a lot of hours of research, and I think I got some really, really good differentiated research on that company that was basically to figure out if it was in fact a really high quality gold mine. And I was able to get confidence that it was. But the problem with that one is management, and management's done a lot of bad M&A, self-dealing. Just not a good management team. And unfortunately, it's another case where if I own the asset myself, I would probably, you know, be able to do really well at the current valuation. But you know, that's just not how it works. So that was frustrating. I think a lot of people also, you know, were value investors were in that one. And people thought that there was a lot more upside than what's played out so far.
When you think about the mistakes that you've made over your investing journey, how have they evolved over time? And for instance, we can say, you know, just as an example, you used to focus on quantitatively really cheap stocks, PE ratios, and that led you to value traps, where now your mistakes are something else, where it's underappreciating management or overestimating management's abilities. How has that evolution of mistakes transformed?
Yeah, I mean, I think you really hit it on the head. You know, when you start out, like I did, I think it's really easy to get sucked in by things that are, you know, so-called value traps, where a more experienced investor would look at it and understand the problems really quickly, rather than just looking at the headline numbers. So yeah, look, I don't do dry bulk shipping anymore, you know, and it's not, it's not just because I'm not interested in, you know, owning cheap stocks. It's just that, you know, I realize that there are a lot of issues and those things dissuade me from a lot of these companies. So yeah, I'd say that my mistakes are probably getting smarter, you know, better, making better mistakes is hopefully, you know, what I'll continue to do as I continue to get better. Yeah, I think return on equity issues, management and capital allocation issues, those are the things that I'm still sometimes, you know, stumbling on, but I'm happier making those issues than I'm making those mistakes than buying like a Chinese fraud.
Yeah, no, I'd agree. I want to pivot now to the second portion of our discussion, which is on game selection and maybe a couple recent investments that you've made that have either performed well or just kind of getting a sense on how you found these. So the first question is, where do you fish for ideas and how do you decide what ponds to fish in?
Yeah, so for people who have followed me on Twitter, they've probably seen that I've been an advocate for, you know, picking a good game, you know, picking games that you can win. So I think the microcap space, and also, you know, even smaller when you call, you know, nanocap space, is the most inefficient market among, you know, the broader public markets, right? So if you know that large cap stocks are generally very heavily analyzed by a lot of smart people, then you probably want to avoid those. And I know there are a lot of people who make persuasive arguments around, you know, time horizons as for, you know, finding inefficiencies in large caps. And they might be right about some of that, but I still think that for a small investor, I think that the greatest opportunities are probably in these tiny companies. So game selection and finding these tiny companies. I mean, when I started out, so I mentioned earlier, I spent my first year of my career investing. I was at BlackRock. And one of the great things about that job was that I had some free time outside of work. It wasn't one of these, you know, like 100-hour week kind of jobs. So I was able to invest my own money a bit when I was at BlackRock. It was much more restrictive when I was working at a hedge fund. So when I was there, I was still doing research for my own account, and I made a project of going through the over-the-counter, US over-the-counter market, you know, the pink sheets. And I also ended up doing the small cap exchange, the venture exchange up in Canada. Sorry if I'm getting off track. I think some people were interested in how I looked at these lists of stocks. And
right,
the way I did this was I was just, you know, I was coming home from work, and this kind of speaks to my social life at the time, but I was spending a few hours into the night after work looking at lists of these companies. I pulled a list. I think it was on the OTC Markets website of, you know, the alphabetical listings, and I looked at every single company. And for the vast majority of those, it was a very quick look. Right off the bat, if a company has no revenue and insignificant assets, it's just a pass. A lot of people are probably thinking, well, you know, how do you really know if something's maybe worthwhile looking at if, you know, you're not going to spend more than 30 seconds on it because it doesn't have any revenue? But I was looking to invest in businesses. So if something has no existing operations, I'm not going to spend my time on
it's just an idea at that point.
Yeah, and to be honest, you know, look, you have a limited amount of time. It's already going to take you know, months to go through these, you know, I think 10,000, 15,000 companies. It's going to take you a long time just to go through it at that rapid pace. You just can't afford to spend the time to look at every company for an hour. But what I did was I went through everything and I made just a very simple, you know, a short list of companies that looked like they were real businesses. They were at or near break even at least, or, you know, growing if they weren't break even yet. And my goal was not to even keep a watch list. My goal was just to find stuff to invest in now. And I ended up finding some interesting stocks from that process. Subsequently, I've gone through some of those exchanges again, and I've kind of tried to do a little bit better refinement using qualitative categorizations. So I could say, you know, this is a high quality company, consistently profitable. You know, there aren't that many of those in these nano caps and micro caps, right? So, you know, that gets kind of like the highest quality grade. And then it keeps going down the quality grade until the bottom is maybe, you know, it has all indications of just being a fraud.
So here's a question, and the reason I asked this is because I've done the exact same thing in the OTC market, starting from the A's and going all the way down. Speaking to the social life, I was actually house sitting in North Carolina. I think it was 2 years ago or a year ago, and I was, you know, by myself. My girlfriend at the time, now fiance, she was back home, and I literally had all waking hours just to do whatever I wanted. And so naturally, I just went through the entire list. And
Living the dream.
when I did that, there was always this part of me that kept saying, "Why don't you just run a screen for what you're already filtering in your head going through these ABC?" And I would tell myself, "No, like I'm doing this because sometimes such companies that are interesting, they don't fit through the screen because the data is not perfect, and so certain screeners aren't going to pick them up." But then I thought, "Man, if we're talking about return on time, like I don't know if what I'm doing is the most productive." And so like that was the internal pushback I had. And I was just wondering if you have had similar, you know, self arguments about that.
Yeah, totally. And you know, at least there was a time when running these screens would actually pull up some of these same companies that were just obviously inexpensive. You know, I'm trying to think when I was looking at the OTC markets the first time. So I ended up making one of my biggest investments at the time, which was still a small investment, was in this a company called Coda Octopus, which was
CODA,
very
right?
profitable. Yeah, back then it had a different ticker and it was on OTC. Now it's
Now
NASDAQ.
it's all
But
full blown on the NASDAQ, trading at
you
$8 a
know,
share.
it had a 9 million market cap, if I remember correctly, and I think it had around 10 million of net debt, and it was earning like $5 million a year or more. And I think at the time it would have been possible to actually pick that up on a screen. And you know, look, there are other things. Even I've also mentioned it doing Canada. You know, there are Canadian companies that also would have been picked. You could pick them up on a screen. But like you say, you know, there are exceptions. One stock that I've mentioned a few times in the past year or two is a Canadian company called FP Newspapers, which is a, you know, a small newspaper company. And in that case, actually, you wouldn't have picked it up on a screen, and that was due to the company structure, in which they own a 49% investment interest in the newspaper itself rather than actually owning the newspaper. So if you just look at the headline, income statement, balance sheet, it's not going to show you what's really going on. They actually own an asset that is this investment in the company, and they don't show the full company's you know, revenue, gross profit, net income. It's
So then that
very much
asset, what
obscured.
does that asset just spit off cash and then it's like interest income or something? Like, does it just drop straight to the income statement or the income
Sort
line
of,
or?
it's sort of like that, but the point is, you know, you wouldn't have really seen what was going on. It would have
Correct.
been very confusing to try to screen for that.
Correct. No, I mean it's one of those battle, you know, internal struggles because the screeners are getting so good, and you know, this is kind of an impromptu pitch for tickers screener that's coming out soon, but it's one of those where you could probably just screen for, you know, market cap under a certain amount and then just go high level. Because one of the things that I've noticed is the wider I set my screens, the better ideas I have. So I might have like 300 different companies, but I'm going to find ones that I would have passed on had I gone more specific.
Yeah. You know, generally, if it's really, really, really easy to find on a screen, there's probably something wrong with it. So I have the same sense that, you know, widening the screen or just throwing the screen out altogether is, you know, maybe the more reliable way to make sure you catch everything. But, you know, at the end of the day, look, it's, you're trading your time. And so
yep.
one of the beautiful things about, you know, being young and not having a lot of capital is you can afford to do it. You know, I think young people should be spending a lot of time, you know, looking for great ideas if they're really trying to grow their capital quickly. You know, they have that resource, so they should take advantage of it.
Walk us through an example of this game selection through the lens of Jura Energy, tickers JECTSX. How did you find this idea? How did you go about structuring your thesis? And then, you know, again, time spent evaluating this company before you decided to make the investment?
You know, yeah. So this is very funny because I actually avoided the resource stocks when I first went through these A to Z.
Which is probably smart.
Well, at the time, I just realized that I knew at the time I didn't have the toolkit to analyze these companies anyway. And look, I have a lot of aversion to commodity companies. But one of the funny things was that when I was busy, you know, poorly analyzing and losing money on Arrow AXL, I did a lot of research on all the other small oil and gas companies that were listed in Canada. In fact, I ended up looking at all of the small oil and gas companies listed in Canada. And when I did that, I was just making notes about what each one looked like and how did it compare to AXL. It really didn't give me too much confidence in my investment in AXL, but I ended up coming up with some, you know, interesting looking stuff. And I just kind of filed that Excel spreadsheet away with my notes about each company. And last year, I ended up pulling that spreadsheet up again and taking another look at everything on it. Because I think it's, you know, I don't have a good system in place to do that every you know, month or quarter or whatever, but I was doing it because I just thought of, you know, another source for finding my next good ideas. And I looked at the companies that I had flagged before, and, you know, Jura was on the list as this small, it's, you know, it has natural gas assets in Pakistan. So very, very, very weird looking company, you know, compared to almost everything else that was listed in Canada. And I pulled up the company, the financials again, and it turned out the company had actually grown significantly. I didn't really understand, you know, the reason for it just looking at the financial statement, but I could see that the company was very profitable. And it was sort of shocking because I think in the maybe the second or third quarter of last year, they had a very clean quarter. I think they earned something like, you know, $2 or $3 million in one quarter of last year. And the market cap, and that's US dollars, and the market cap of the company last year was still hovering around $5 million, you know, US dollars. So this was a company that had earned like half of its market cap, I think, in just one quarter. And so, you know, you don't have to do a lot more than that to get my attention. So yeah. When I saw that, and I saw that it had almost no trading volume, but it had traded a little bit. I also saw that one of the insiders, a director, had bought a big block. He was one of the only, you know, buyers in the previous year. He had actually bought a pretty big block of stock after some of these great numbers came out. And I was thinking, you know, this is nuts. So as is often the case, you know, there was no information about the company, you know, anywhere in social media or, you know, Seeking Alpha or any forums. Obviously, they have no sell side coverage. So you just have to go and dig through what you can find. And chances are, if you're finding a company that, you know, is trading at less than 1x earnings, you're going to like it, even if, you know, there's some hair on it, or even if you don't love everything about it or all the assets. So I just ended up doing a lot of research. I found out a lot about the individual assets. I built some model, you know, but you don't really have to do all of that. It was very simple. You could have just figured out that it was a real business and they have real assets and it's trading at, you know, below 1x run rate earnings. And so I bought as much as I could.
So then question for you, and again, this might be naive, but I just feel the need to ask it. How do you differentiate between a company like JEC that's trading, basically made half its market cap and earnings in one quarter, versus these Chinese companies that have similar quantitative aspects where they're trading at 2, 2.5, maybe 1.5 times earnings? What are some easy tells that you can go, okay, this is a legitimate business, and okay, this is a fraud?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. You know, one of the funniest things is that actually the reason for some of these companies like JEC being so ridiculously cheap is actually the same reason why they should have very healthy valuations, which is that the management is non-promotional. So if you have a fraud, if you have a fake business and you're trying to make money by, you know, fooling foreign investors by selling them, you know, overpriced stock in that fake business, you're going to have to actually make an effort to make sure that people know about the company.
Yep.
So when you find something that's just being run very quietly, doesn't have a lot of press releases, doesn't have an investor presentation, isn't giving any, you know, roadshow, you kind of have a sense that it's not a fraud because it doesn't work. I mean, they can't make any money doing that. They're not raising capital. There's no benefit to running the company in that way if it's not real.
Right.
That's not the whole reason, because you know, that's not the whole explanation. You need to actually do your research. In the case of JEC, it was actually not so hard to do that research because they're a part owner in almost all of their assets. So they have much larger partners that are oil and gas companies. And some of those are actually large publicly traded companies mm-hmm. in Pakistan. And you can verify that JEC in fact owns these partial interests in these oil fields, and the other parts are owned by these large companies that, you know, are very real and pay dividends and, you know, are very clear about what their assets are and who owns the other stakes in them. So in that sense, you know, I was able to get a quite a high degree of confidence that it was everything was sort of, in that sense, everything was kosher.
I think there's a fine line, and I'm glad you mentioned kind of the promotional aspect of it, because I had an investment recently that turned out to be a complete dud, and I wrote it. I sized it really small. So basically the thesis I had was this thing's either a 20 bagger or it's a zero. And so I sized it as basically a call option and wrote it down 80% before management put the fork in me. And one of the things looking back on it was, you know, it smelled like vaporware, and I should have listened to, you know, my partner Alex about it. But B, they kept promoting and they kept raising. And so not only did they promote, but they also did equity raises that were extremely dilutive to shareholders. And I think there's this give and take, right? Because when you're investing in these smaller companies, there's an element of you, if you want to own the business for a long time, there's an element of you that wants management to get out and tell the story to increase liquidity, because you want to see this company succeed. And sometimes part of that success is gaining access to higher liquidity markets. And that's not even to say that capital raising is bad, because sometimes you need that equity infusion to keep doing what you want to do and take share. But there is such a fine line between telling your story and then promoting your stock price. And I hope over time that I can get better at distinguishing those two.
Yeah. And, you know, look, there are some downsides in management teams that are completely non-promotional. I think the biggest risk involved in those situations is that management will eventually buy out minority shareholders at a price that, you know, the minority shareholders are unhappy with. And that's something that, you know, you're never going to be fully comfortable with it. If you do research into the management team, you know, you might get more comfort. But certainly, the ideal is a management team that is, you know, really, really focused on executing on the business, but still appreciates that they have, you know, minority shareholders, and those people want to understand what's going on in the business. So it's hard to find a team that can really execute well on all those things at the same time.
I know you said you weren't a fan of these E&P energy companies, but I'm going to go with another example, another energy company, Hemisphere Energy, HME. again, walk us through that, how you found the idea. Seems like you're kind of on this energy kick recently. And I mean, it kind of makes sense, right? Energy went negative, tons of companies got blown out. So I'm sure there's some roadkill that you can shine up there. So walk us through the thesis on this one.
Oh yeah, I love roadkill. You know, look, the funny thing is that I actually don't like energy. I mean, I think you'd have to be nuts.
Are you
to
sure?
Love E&P companies. I'm changing. I love companies that are real businesses with good margins, you know, decent return on equity, that, you know, consistently make money and trade at really, really low multiples. And recently, I found a few of these companies that are in that profile in the energy space. You know, Hemisphere was on the list of the companies I had looked at when I had first been researching AXL. And I went back to Hemisphere and I really, really liked what I saw. And I decided to do a deep dive. So I wrote up a pitch for Hemisphere. It's posted on my Twitter account. So anyone who's listening can feel free to download that and get my whole pitch. But in that case, you know, we're talking about a company that is one of the lowest cost producers. They have one core oil asset in Canada, in Alberta. And it's been a very, very, very under the radar company for a long time because it was really one of the very smallest companies listed on the exchange. And they've been growing, but it hasn't been picked up on people's radar screens quite yet. And not only that, but the asset is very different from most other energy companies' assets in that it doesn't have a fast declining oil production base. In fact, it has a production base that is likely to increase in the next couple of years. So I saw this business, and again, you know, almost no profile on social media, you know, no write-ups, no sell-side coverage. And I can see that this thing was trading at a pretty low single-digit run rate earnings multiple. You know, I think it's something like 3 to 4 times earnings, and my pitch is what the number I gave for my estimate. You know, growing, and a couple of years out, it could be, you know, something like 2 times earnings. So I'm telling you, if you can find me non-energy companies with that kind of profile, I'll buy them. I'd love to buy those things. But I just can't find anything like that, you know? And I really shouldn't be able to find anything like that because the valuations are nonsense. So I'm finding some stuff in the energy space, not through any interest in speculating on the price of oil or gas or anything else, and not for any love of the business model for energy, but just recognizing that, you know, you can find decent assets in the energy space. And if you buy them at really, really egregiously cheap valuations, I think you should do very, very well.
Yeah, no, agreed. And, you know, I got stung pretty bad buying an energy stock, actually former SPAC in 2019, and haven't really touched the space since. The burn still stings, but it's definitely something worth looking into.
You know, it's almost like, I feel like the energy microcaps are almost like the trash heap within the trash heap, because 100%. a lot of people will feel like they're really far off the beaten path because they're looking at microcaps or nanocaps, but most of those people will still have a don't touch list that includes resource stocks and often banks and financials. I'm ashamed to say I still don't really look at banks or financials, but I feel like I now have a decent enough toolkit to analyze some of these energy companies that, you know, this is an edge. You know, it's not because I'm an expert, because I'm not an expert, but it's because I think I have enough understanding to realize when something is in fact a no-brainer and the conviction to, you know, to go out and size that up as a position.
Okay, so let's dig into that for a second. When it comes to energy specifically, what metrics give you that confidence that something's a no-brainer? Is it enterprise value to, you know, reserves, underground reserves, available reserves? Is it, you know, something along those lines where you're developing some heuristics where almost like an offhand, you can tell, okay, this one's a no-brainer?
I love cash flow. I love earnings and cash flow. So I feel like the, you know, the surest sign of value is cash. And if a company is consistently earning free cash flow, which is often, you know, also reflected in earnings, then that business has value. So there are definitely going to be cheap stocks that I miss because they have an undeveloped asset that isn't throwing off any cash quite yet, but maybe has a lot of value. I'm probably going to miss those. And I'm okay with that because I've been able to find some stuff that I think fits into my strike zone. So, you know, as I said in my write-up on HME, on Hemisphere, I was very focused on, you know, the free cash flow and, you know, the earnings ability for this company and their high margins. And if you know that, you know, you really have what you need to figure out what the, you know, what the NAV or what the asset valuation might be, or at least some sort of range of that.
You mentioned passing up on ideas, and it's a perfect segue to inverting this game selection question, which is discussing ideas that you've passed on, errors of omission that ended up being tremendous winners. And I know that there's always some value. There's always some redundancy in this question. I think it was EBIT Daddy that put out on Twitter, you know, basically saying like, you know, no shit, there's errors of omission. Like if only I would have just bought Google, Apple, Facebook, all at the IPO. Obviously, we're not talking about those. What I'm more concerned with is ideas that were potentially inside of your strike zone that you may have looked at, may have kind of peeled a couple layers of the onion back, but for some reason decided not to pursue. When you look back on those ideas, what were those kind of uncle points that made you not pull the trigger?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I think the way that I've really messed up in the past, or I should say, you know, the things that I've missed that I maybe should have gotten, have to do a lot with also the way that I've evolved and hopefully improved as an investor. And so I've continuously transitioned more towards higher quality businesses that are, you know, understandable and are growing, and perhaps on near-term numbers, they aren't so incredibly cheap looking, but if you're willing to look out, you know, 2-3 years, they might be, you know, a good value. And this has probably been the case for a lot of people. And, you know, there's a lot of growth stuff out there that's probably pretty richly valued right now. So I can't say if, you know, that's something that I continue to feel that I'm making that mistake. But, you know, to give you a sense, like I bought Expel a few years ago. I think it was the summer of 2018. Yep. Because it fit into my strike zone, which was a really narrow strike zone. And at the time, I thought I was buying it at roughly 10 times run rate earnings, which were growing at an incredible clip. So it was really, really easy for me to buy it. But at the same time, I realized that there was stuff that I should have been buying at 30 times earnings that I was just immediately passing on because it was at 30 times earnings.
Right.
So, I mean, I'm trying to think of exact examples. Like, you know, my friend Connor Haley, who runs AltaFox, has made a lot of really great investment decisions on companies that didn't look incredibly cheap on near-term numbers. I'm trying to think, like, you know, one example has been Evolution Gaming out of Sweden. And, you know, it's a really high quality business, has really great margins, beautiful business, right? You know, it's sometimes tough for me to get comfortable with something that is at, call it, you know, a 30 times plus earnings multiple. And one of the things that I've, you know, gotten from my Expel investment has been around, you know, understanding a business well enough to feel comfortable at that earnings multiple. And, you know, full disclosure, I've sold quite a bit of my Expel position, and I'm not advocating for that as a, you know, underpriced stock at the moment. But my point is that it still takes a lot of time to understand a business well enough to get conviction to own it at a price that is not so cheap on its face. And that's the struggle for me. You know, a friend of mine actually pitched me Shopify about 2 years ago in spring of 2019. I think it was at around 300, maybe something around $300. He had done an incredible amount of research, really smart guy.
Yeah.
He had a lot of proprietary, well, not proprietary completely, but he had gotten a lot of different data sets together. He had done huge, huge amounts of research. And he was mm-hmm. pounding the table on this with me. And I could tell how much conviction he has. He's a smart guy. I really could tell he had an incredible amount of conviction. This was a company that was going to just continue to shoot the lights out for years.
Yep.
But it's been said before, you know, you can't just get someone else's conviction. And without having personally spent, you know, the weeks or months of research that this friend of mine had spent to understand Shopify, there's just no way I was going to be able to understand it well enough to buy it. And that's, you know, that's usually the biggest problem, is just not having the time to get the conviction to own some of those stocks.
It's funny you mentioned that. I think one thing that I've tried to implement, and again, this could be wrong for me or for other people out there, but this is kind of how I work, how I'm a little bit comfortable. There's a select few number of investors, you know, I follow all of them on Twitter, but there's a few investors where if they bring me a stock, or if they say, hey, I'm really bullish on this thing, it's one of my largest positions. And, you know, they send me either, you know, the pitch deck that they've done or the write-up that they've done. If I have enough confidence and conviction in that person and their track record and kind of who they are as an investor from a philosophical standpoint, to me, it does not take that much to initiate at least a starter position on an idea like that. So, you know, for instance, Connor has shot the lights out of the stadium, basically, with some of his ideas lately. It would not take a lot of conviction for me to at least follow him into a starter position on some of these ideas, whether that's, you know, 1% or, you know, 1.5%, just to get my feet wet as I get comfortable. Because again, it goes back to developing conviction in a philosophy that is similar to yours. And so that's, you know, that's again, that's my personal strategy, but it is something of a pushback, where if I'm comfortable with that person, if I have a good enough relationship with them, it doesn't take much for me to say, okay, cool. Like if it's good enough for you to put 5, 10, 15% of your portfolio in, then it's probably good enough for me to do 1% starter position as I get more comfortable with the name.
Yeah, I hear you. And I totally understand that approach. You know, I personally don't do that. I don't buy anything without having the same amount of due diligence on my own part that I feel like I would need. And I've definitely missed out on some things because of that. But at the end of the day, I always feel like, you know, you can't take someone else's conviction. And look, I've been wrong plenty of times, even though I have a pretty good track record. I would, you know, and I would feel like, I'm sure there are some people out there who have followed me into some of the ideas that I've tweeted about or written about on Microcap Club, and not all of those are successful ideas.
Correct.
And I realize that, you know, coming from that side, I personally don't want to own anything that isn't really my own conviction, you know, that's underpinning the investment at the end of the day.
I think it was Dennis Hong of ShawSpring Partners who said they won't invest in a company at all if they don't think that they can put, I think it was 10% of their portfolio in that name, which again is kind of the opposite end, where, you know, no starter positions, and we're only going to invest if we want to put 10% of our book. And I totally get that. And there's a part of my brain that resonates with that. And it's just this internal struggle I have.
Yeah. All right. You know, it's tough to spend the time on tiny positions. That's part of it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So let's back in now to, how you think about valuation from a broad range. And the reason I ask is there's kind of two pendulums, call it a barbell approach, if you will, where on one side of the barbell, you've got these very detailed DCFs, 10-year models, analyzing the income statement, balance sheet, cash flows, everything's in Excel, nice and beautiful. And then on the other end of the barbell, you have basically a back of the envelope. Hey, you know what? If they grow revenue X and they hit these margins because of X, Y, Z, you apply 15 times EBIT multiple on that run rate, and there you go. Where do you fall in that barbell approach?
Man, I am such a back of the envelope guy. Sometimes I'm actually embarrassed by how bad my modeling is. Like I've had times when a friend of mine might've said, you know, oh, I love that stock you were pitching to me. You know, can you send me your model? And I'm like, oh God, like, do I have a model? Like, I forgot if I actually did something more than, you know, like a 10 by 10 cell, you know, Excel work page. Like, I feel like modeling, and you hear this from a lot of people, and I think it's right, is that modeling is often just a way to get conviction without really learning very much. You can definitely, there are definitely uses for modeling. You know, one of the nice things about it is it forces you to actually look at all of the items on a company's financial statement. And so if there's something that is weird or, you know, potentially problematic or a sign of fraud or something, you know, you're going to find it. I think that's actually one of the better parts about the process of modeling is, you know, the discipline to look at everything and pull it in and, you know, try to figure out, you know, what's driving what number. But as far as figuring out, you know, what something is going to look like in, you know, 10 years, you're probably better off trying to understand the competitive landscape and, you know, the more holistic view of the company, in my opinion. So I'm a multiples guy. I'll look out a couple of years if I'm trying to model something, but it's going to be very simple.
That's how I have evolved over time. And I think when I first started investing, and I don't know if anybody's had similar instances, but I always equated complexity with level of knowledge or legitimacy, if that makes sense. So the more complex my model, the more legit I was as an investor. And it took me a long time to realize that I think that's the inverse, where the more simple you can make things, the more legitimate you have become as an investor. And the only reason I say that is because one of my mentors who I actually had the pleasure of meeting in person was a gentleman who returned, I think it was 18% CAGR for 30 years. In his partnership. So again, that number right there puts him kind of in the top echelon of investors of all time. And I would ask him to send me his annual letters, and I would just read through them. And his ideas were so simple. And I was, you know, I asked him at one point, I said, "Hey, what do you do for modeling? Like, where's your Excel stuff?" And he said, "I don't use Excel." He said, "I just wait until a stock gets cheap enough where I don't really need to use much more math beyond basic arithmetic." And that's when it hit me, like, wow, like that right there is to me the kind of apex of how you want to structure a world-class investment.
Yeah, you know, I will say that there are lots of really, really smart people who do really, really advanced modeling. And correct. So I won't knock the idea of modeling, but like the point about game selection, I'm trying to find investments that I don't need to model because they're so obvious, right? So if you're playing a hard game, maybe modeling can, you know, add to your edge in understanding an investment. I'm trying to play an easy game. And so I'm trying to find things that are so easy, you could just figure it out in your head or a couple of lines in an Excel spreadsheet.
Sounds like you've been listening to a lot of Yen Lau from Arvat Capital.
I'm sorry, I actually don't even know that guy. But
are you serious, dude?
I'm pleased if there are other people out there who are on the same page as me.
Oh my gosh, I'm gonna send you, when this is done, I'm sending you his YouTube channel. The dude is a legend, and his whole mantra is he wants to invest in unfair fights. That's literally all he talks about.
Yeah.
That's shocking. Well, you sound just like him. So yeah, I'm gonna send you all of his stuff. But no, it's always funny to kind of get that kind of give and take between complex models and not. And I think at some point most of my investments fall under a rough range of expectations, and it's very general. Like there's very little precision in some of my investment takes, where in some cases it literally comes down to me just saying, look, I think this thing could be a lot bigger in 3 to 5 years than it is now. Like how big, I don't know, but I just think, you know, because of XYZ, obviously you have to have a hypothesis that you can back up with certain metrics. But I think, you know, because of XYZ, I think this thing could be much bigger in 5 years than it is now. What that is, I have no idea.
Yeah, makes sense.
Now I want to end this conversation because we're about over an hour, and this is flown by. Like I said, we could probably talk for 2.5-3 hours. I want to do two more topics. So the first topic is kind of where you're finding ideas currently. And we'll talk a little bit about portfolio construction. And then the last bit, we're going to get to Twitter Q&A for any questions that we haven't addressed here so far. So for the first question, how many names do you keep in this portfolio? I know you carry a lot of illiquid, microcap, nanocap names. How diversified are you given that strategy?
Yeah. So right now, it's sort of a normal kind of looking portfolio compared to what I've had historically, I think, which is that really, you know, my top five or top seven positions is the vast majority of the portfolio. I think I've probably got, you know, maybe half a dozen tiny positions, stuff that I've been able to buy a very, very small amount because they're, you know, they're nano caps. And a lot of that's just because, like I said, I can't buy more of it. So I don't have the capacity to understand 50 companies really well, and right. I'm not going to try to do it. And at the same time, I don't have 50 good ideas. So at any given time, I probably have a few really good ideas or things that I think are really good ideas. So I want those to make up, you know, the bulk of my exposure. I've actually historically, I think I've actually still not been concentrated enough in my top two or three best ideas. I probably would have benefited by just cutting, you know, number 6, 7, and 8 and just put it all back into 1, 2, and 3. Mm-hmm. I still do it because I think maybe there's some element of prudence of, you know, you really can't know, something can still go against you, you know, even if you have really high conviction. So I'm almost never going to have more than like 20% at cost in something. And if something goes above like 30%, you know, I'm starting to trim almost as like a rule. Mm-hmm. But that said, you know, I'm happy to have positions that are, you know, they started as 10% positions and now they're 20%, you know, that's no problem for me.
Got it. And then couple other questions about ideas. What corners of the market are attracting your attention today besides energy? Because we know you're a big energy guy.
Big energy guy. Well, you know, the funny thing is that I still love Canada. I'm an American. I love the Canadian market. I found it surprising how persistently inefficient the small cap Canadian market has been. Because if you look back, you know, 5, 10 years, you know, that's where stuff like Expel started. You know, that's where you could have bought Expel at it's probably a 5 million market cap. And now it's like over 2 billion. I mean, and it's not the only example. There are quite a few guys, investors, some of whom are on Microcap Club, who made quite a bit of money, you know, looking back 10 or more years in the, you know, Canadian market. I don't have a good explanation for why Canada is still so inefficient. You know, the US market is really big and there are a lot of people look at it. So, I mean, I still look at the US market. I've tried to look at, you know, some foreign markets. I think maybe people have a sense that I actually spend more time on foreign stocks than I actually do. I only speak English. So it's a big hurdle for me to look at, you know, non-English speaking countries. I've done a little bit in Israel, but that's a lot harder to just understand all the disclosures. And I just thought it was a little bit less picked over compared to parts of Europe. That said, you know, I've looked at European companies. I've owned and still do own at least one stock in Australia. I've looked at Australia and New Zealand. If I can find stuff in North America, it's always going to be my preference because I feel like culturally and, you know, by proximity, it's easier to understand. It's easier to do research. If I can't fill a portfolio with those companies, then it's just going to kind of force me to go further and further afield.
Yeah, no, it's funny. It's funny you mentioned the international stocks and sticking to your language barrier, because when it comes to foreign stocks, if I can't wrap my head around the country, the culture, the accounting and all that stuff. I'm only looking for pure monopoly plays at that point where companies are huge industry leaders, 70, 80% market share. I think that buffers you from a lot of the risks that come with investing in foreign companies. But, you know, again, it's always more intriguing to find something in your own language so you don't have to go to onlinedoctranslator.com, which at this point I should have them as a sponsor to the podcast because I use them so frequently. But yeah, no, it's Canada is one of those interesting ones because I think everybody assumes that it's just energy and silver miners and just a bunch of junior miners and there's nothing else but that. And so they pass it over.
Yeah. And, you know, like, as I said, I have done some stuff in those spaces as well, but yeah, there is more in Canada and I can't really explain why it's still kind of inefficient.
Let's move to Twitter questions. We had quite a few actually, and we answered some of them here. Brian McCann has a good question. So at Bootstrap68, most listeners on this podcast probably know Brian. He's a pretty well-known microcap investor. He asks your motivation for becoming a full-time investor and just kind of what keeps you motivated to do the hard work and to start with the A's and go A through Z, because that obviously takes some discipline. So what is that motivation behind that?
As far as, you know, being a full-time investor and working for myself, you know, obviously I valued the freedom that comes with that and setting my own pace of work and not going to the office. So that's probably the easy part of the question. The other stuff is, I guess it just comes down to that. I love it. I love games. I'm a really competitive player. You know, you don't want to play a board game against me because, you know, if I don't win, I'm at least going to make it, you know, probably unpleasant for everybody because of how competitive I'm going to be. I have sort of a rule that, you know, like if my friends ask to play board games, I will try to like push it to something else unless they're insistent. I like the process. I like finding things that other people, have kind of skipped over. I mentioned maybe at the beginning of the podcast when I was a kid, I had some kind of side businesses. You know, one of those things was I would go around my hometown on my bicycle when I was like in middle school or high school on the weekends. And I would just go to like, I would hit up garage sales and I would just find stuff that I thought was cool. And, you know, maybe I could sell. I sold stuff on eBay. And it wasn't really just for the money. It was just because I thought it was really cool. Like I was going and finding interesting things and, you know, I could make a little side money on it. And it's sort of not so dissimilar from finding a, you know, a $5 million company. You know, you can't sell it on eBay, but you know, it ends up feeling like it gives me a little bit of the same rush, the same exhilaration doing that, or, you know, understanding a business is sort of like, you know, playing this game and understanding, you know, how this game works. So it's probably a little bit of a lot of those things together.
It's a lot of Gary V hustle back in the day.
Well, I don't know if I wasn't as successful as Gary, I'm sure is, but it was fun and I liked doing it.
I like to describe investing, because you mentioned just kind of the competitiveness of it and almost, you know, the rush of finding deals. To me, investing is like this beautiful marriage between treasure hunting and like sports activity, where you have the competition of others, but the goal is to find this buried treasure faster than anybody else, or to find treasure that no one else has found. It's just kind of this really beautiful marriage of these two really, really cool endeavors. So that was a great question from Brian. Another question we have is from, I'm going to butcher this guy's name, Zeljko Obrenović. His ticker is at Obrenović Zeljko, Zeljko. How do you make sure to extract the most value for the time invested when going through a market from A to Z? And more specifically, because we already touched on that, but more specifically, what does your output look like? So when you're going through A to Z, do you make notes? Like, do you say company, ticker, company, and then notes and then Excel? And then how detailed will you go in that initial search?
Yeah. So I made a mention a little bit that my process evolved because I did this in more than one iteration, but very, very quick notes. I mean, like it's going to be about maximizing the value of use of your time. So you can't write, you know, you can't write a thesis about each individual company that looks interesting if you're looking at hundreds or thousands of companies. Usually my notes might look something like, you know, if we're talking about a little widget manufacturer, I'll say, you know, this company makes widgets, inconsistent profitability, looks to be around 5x earnings, you know, keep an eye on this new product line or something like that. And then, you know, my newer iteration of doing this, I would probably give that company, you know, a rating on, you know, like a scale where one is the highest quality and six maybe is a fraud, then maybe that kind of company gets, you know, a three or something. But, you know, everyone's going to have their own style. And I'm not saying that my style is fully developed. And to be honest, I don't even spend a lot of time doing research like that anymore because it's not as interesting for me to find, you know, something that doesn't trade at all. And, you know, something like, you know, Jura, sure, in that case, I was able to make it a, you know, a decent position, but I've got, like I said before, I've got a handful of companies in my portfolio now that I just can't scale up. So, you know, it's not the same value to me now with my, you know, larger capital base as it was when I was, you know, 20 years old in college doing this. It doesn't move the needle as much for me finding something that is, you know, an opportunity to put $5,000 or $10,000 into a stock.
Right. And that's a perfect example of how performance in microcaps almost automatically leads the best investors to not be able to invest in those ideas. So it's always kind of the better the investor, the less their investable universe. And so it always leaves room for these initial investors, these, you know, startup investors to scan those fields because the good guys have gotten so good that now their returns are so high, their capital base is so high that they can't find that idea that you can invest in.
Yeah. I mean, I feel the exact same way about that. I've actually said to a couple of friends in the past, you know, look, if I'm investing in nanocaps in 10 years, you know, you got to pull me aside and tell me to just, you know, go back to a day job because it means that I must not have been so good at it. Right. I mean, you know, if I'm, you know, putting up good investment performance, then I shouldn't be able to do this for too much longer. So yeah, it's always a progression. And I'm very thankful that guys like Warren Buffett are not, you know, my competition. So, you know, it's a good process that the successful people do graduate.
Kaladin at Kaladin_LLP asks, which index are you going to conquer next?
I don't think I've conquered anything.
Well, you went through the OTCs and the TSX venture from A to Z. I would say that that's conquering from a pure depth perspective.
Well, you know, I gave a little shot at Poland. I quickly gave up on Poland. I don't know. The Polish language is tough. It's tough.
Dude, there are so many good businesses in Poland. Get out of here.
I know. Well, see, actually, part of my feeling was that because you actually say that, and there are other people who have also done a lot of interesting research in Poland. You know, right now, in fact, the next one on my list, if I can get around to it in the next couple of weeks, I want to start looking at South Africa. I think South Africa fits the bill for a pretty neglected market, English financials. You know, the country has been, it's had a tough time economically for a long time. I don't know a lot of people who are talking about South African stocks. And I've gotten some kind of hints here and there that there are cheap things down there. So that would probably be the next one on my list. And importantly, because, you know, I'm doing most of my trading nowadays on a mix of Interactive Brokers and Fidelity, I can actually trade this market, I believe, on IB. Whereas,
are you sure? Because I don't know if you can buy South African stocks on Interactive Brokers.
Well, maybe I'll double check that, but I thought I could.
Yeah, double check, because that would, I mean, that was one of the things that pissed me off about the Brazilian market. I found so many amazing Brazilian companies and then went to go to Interactive Brokers. Can't buy them. I was so pissed off.
You know, when I was at my old hedge fund job, one time for fun for a day or two, I actually looked at the Jamaican market. You know, you wouldn't really think about Jamaica, but you know, they speak English down there, and there were some cheap Jamaican stocks, maybe, you know, 5-6 years ago, stuff at, you know, 4 or 5 times earnings, and that's the kind of thing. I don't think you can access that on any of the U.S. retail brokerages either, but. You know, there are probably greater opportunity sets out there if you are on a, you know, a full service prime brokerage.
Yeah. Another interesting one, or actually speaking of South Africa, do you know Rudy Van Niekerk over at Desert Lion?
No, I can't say I do. I have a pathetic, you know, international investing network.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm realizing that now, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to send you his website. So he runs specifically a South African focused value shop. So he's your guy to talk to if you're getting into the South African stocks. I tried to get him on the podcast, but he graciously declined. So I'm going to try again, but he's your South African go-to guy. And he's got a bunch of, you know, names that you can start with there, but he's kind of pipeline into that space.
My goal is, as usual, it's going to be to find something that he's never heard of.
That's going to be tough because I think he's like you and gone through A to Z.
All right. Challenge accepted.
Challenge accepted. All right. Well, Harris, this has been such a cool conversation. I'm gonna wrap up with the last two questions that I ask everybody. So first one, where can you go to learn, where can people go to learn more about you?
Well, I don't have much of a presence outside of Twitter. So I guess, you know, you can go on Twitter and, you know, my account is, at Otter Market. You know, feel free to send me a message on there. You can also send me an email, at, ottermarket@gmail.com. So, you know, I check that inbox and, I'd be happy to talk stocks because, it's what I do and it's what I like to do.
Beautiful. Last question I have for you. If you could have dinner with one person from the past or the present, who would it be and why?
I think I would say, I don't know if you've gotten this answer before. I think I would go with Bertrand Russell, the British. He was a British mathematician and philosopher, really big in the field of logic. I've read a couple of his books. I really like him. I think he was really one of the greatest thinkers and very flexible, you know, like recognizing that he doesn't know everything. And also I admired that he was not afraid to be, you know, contentious or to disagree with people. So, you know, maybe I'm looking for someone who I'm sort of admiring, or I would appreciate, you know, talking to someone like that. You know, hopefully learn a thing or two.
Awesome. I love that answer. What book did you read of his? Do you know?
Well, one of them, so it's funny because he's not just a mathematician. One of them was about sort of, I guess it was almost like a self-help book called The Conquest of Happiness, which is about him trying to, you know, figure out what makes people happy in life and going about that in a sort of logical process, the way that he does, you know, his other stuff. And he's written a lot of other, you know, books and articles. So there's a lot to go through if you're interested in reading some of his works.
Awesome. Sounds good. I can't wait to dig in. Harris, thanks so much for coming on the show. This is going to be fun for people to listen to. And I know that they're going to get a lot of value from what you had to say today. So thank you so much.
Oh, thanks a lot for having me. Really appreciate it.
This episode is brought to you by Ticker. Ticker.com is focused on bringing institutional level investment research to you, the individual investor. Ticker.com is powered by S&P Global Capital IQ and has coverage of over 50,000 stocks globally with financial data, estimates, valuation metrics, ownership percentages, transcript filings, news, and more. ValueHive listeners can join Ticker's free beta trial today at ticker.com/hive. That's TIKR.com/hive.